The Rebbe gave a sermon, or Dvar Torah, whatever you want to say, or Sichot, as these were called, on a Saturday, on a Yontif. You can't write. You can't take notes. And yet, every single week, I receive the Sichot of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Every single week, there's material in the Allgemeine Journal, a full page about the Torah of the Rebbe. My question to you, Simon, is this. And then at the end, I want to give you a quote from a noted author and get your reaction to it. What did you do for the Rebbe for 14 years? How did you do it? And it's something that blows your mind that there are people walking the face of the earth, like these two men, who are capable and able to do what Simon Jacobson and his colleagues did. Please.
First of all, I'd like to acknowledge my father, who I saw entered.
Where is he?
We welcome you, Gershon, and we're happy that you're here. And I know that you're filled with a deep sense of nachas at the deep intellectuality of your two sons and their ability, their magnificent eloquence, both of them, in their own style and their own way, to convey it to all of us.
Yeah. Well, you stole a joke from me, but okay. I was going to say, this man and his wife, my mother, gave birth to this young genius. For 14 years, my job as part of a small group, including my dear brother, I should add, and I'll share with you something in a moment about that, were what was called in Lubavitch and in Hasidic lore, chozrim. Or in the singular, chozer. A chozer means a repeater. That's what it literally means. But as we developed our vocabulary, we turned it into an oral scribe, which is essentially when the Rebbe would speak on Shabbos and holidays, when tape recorders were not used and notes were not taken, we would have to memorize and remember these long talks.
An hour, or if not more.
Halavai.
I wish. Yeah. Let's put it this way, an hour at a time.
An hour at a time.
The Farbrengens on Shabbos would begin at 1:30 p.m. in the afternoon, and would sometimes last in the winter months till around 5, and the summer months sometimes till 7 or 8. So we're talking about 4, 5, 6 hours of these dense talks. We had no idea what the Rebbe was going to say. So it could go in any direction, and you just had to be ready for it all. In truth, I should say, what makes me most proud is the fact that this has always really been, as Rabbi mentioned before we came into the room, really the tradition of Judaism. When you say Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah. What does it mean by oral Torah? Torah Shebiksav, Chumash, as we know it, the Bible, Tanakh, was written down by Moses, by others that came after him, Isaiah the prophet, and the different prophets and the different books. But Torah Shebapeh, which is the real, proportionately speaking, the large body of Jewish scholarship, still remains today still called Baal Peh, oral. There was a point 1,000 years after Moses, where a man, Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, right at, close to the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, beginning of the Common Era, felt the need, and his as his colleagues did, the need to put down on paper, commit to paper, these oral teachings. But that was not a small feat. It was never meant to really be written down for many, many reasons. So I include myself, and I include my brother, though he's a little younger than I, but I remember him very fondly, and it's one of the most precious memories in my life, standing right in front of me, a short little child. Now he's taller than I am. He was a little kid in front of the Rebbe's Verbringen, and he would listen, and I would listen. In those early years when he was only 9, 10, 11 years old, and you know, there's always another side to it. He may tell you that was the beginning of the end, but you know, I was like, so to speak, shaping his destiny. On the other hand, I have no doubt that what you've heard now from my brother's mouth, and including from myself, is a direct tribute to the hours of standing and listening. Because speaking is not speaking. Speaking is listening. That's all it is. And listening is not an easy thing to do. So we would stand there for hours. When my brother was younger, he may not have comprehended it all. But I remember Yosef Itzchak, I used to tell him, look, when you hear the Rebbe winding down, and I would give him a kick when it was winding down, I said, remember whatever he says, the phrases. Because at the end of the talks, the Rebbe would go into long blessings that didn't always have the same structure as the rest of the talk, which was quite structured. Remember? You remembered then? Well,
we'll talk about it at the therapist, yeah?
Okay. What therapist? And as my brother grew older, and I say it because I think it's the right context, he became a master himself. And it was a small group of maybe 5-6 of us that right after Shabbos, right after the Verbringen actually, we would sit down, review it all, reconstruct it. Then after Shabbos ended, we finally could take a pen and paper. The group of us, one of us would repeat it. We had a great teacher still with us. His name was Rabbi Yoel Kahn, who was like the master, the older gentleman. And we would review it and put it down on paper. And then began the hard work of preparing it for publication. Now, there are no words I can tell you what kind of both delight and torture this was all at once. It was real torture because it's hard enough to write your own thoughts in an organized way, let alone to go into the mind of another person, and let alone the mind of a Torah scholar like the Rebbe. So it was really torture. I remember banging my head literally in the wall, trying to figure it out, the confusion, the difficulty. But then at the same time, the unbelievable pleasure when it would begin to emerge. From the confusion, the picture would begin to emerge. From the confusion. And suddenly, you know, the whole thing would come alive. And we published this, and I had the privilege of writing, I believe, over 1,200 of these talks. It's probably around 30 volumes. My brother, in the 80s, began to write some of the material as well. And we worked very well together, at least so I thought. But the gift of being able to, and the opportunity to be able to do this, I would not be sitting here, I would not be who I am, I would not be anything that I have accomplished if I did not have those time of listening. So I want to say one thing about how do you do it? How do you listen in this way? There's two factors that I always share with people, and I know time is of limited.
Don't worry about it, go right ahead.
Yeah. But I would love to hear my brother share some of his tips.
Okay.
Because he never wanted to share it with me. so maybe now. So two things that really stood out to the secret of real memory. And everybody has memory tips and gimmicks and this, you do that. It's really not about gimmicks at all. It's the exact opposite of gimmicks. It's shutting everything down to be able to be a true listener. That's what it's about. But shutting down is harder than loading up, especially if you think you have a lot to load. The art of listening, a child has innately mastered that art, is the art of not allowing your ego to get in the way. When you are all here listening to us speak, and we're listening to you, as adults, the first thing you think of, I like what they have to say, I don't like what they have to say, I like this one, I don't like that one, this one's more dramatic, this one's more profound.
Who's what?
And then the next sentence, You say, no, maybe this one's more, you know.
Oh, very good.
Okay? Cover our bases. And you say, I like this, I don't like it, I can make money with this, I can't make money with this. Even though there's nothing that was said here that we didn't give them our financial tips, right? We learned them from our father.
Hope you get the joke. Not to make money.
Right. Yeah, diamonds, emeralds, precious stones.
But no money. But,
right. No.
We don't believe in that, yeah?
Yeah. So that's how adults think. I like this, I don't like it. As soon as you begin to say in your own mind the words, I like it, I don't like it, you begin to process, to quantify everything that makes you strong. You think you're doing a great thing. Hey, you're listening. Thank God you didn't fall asleep. Thank God not only are you listening passively, you're processing. You're processing it, stimulating new ideas. Wow, this is really great. You know, all that is excellent for processing, but it's not excellent for memory. You know why? Because you're already a partner in the transmission. I'm sharing a few words, and you're already processing and saying, quantifying, qualifying, actualizing, applying, etc., etc. When a child listens, a child doesn't think, I like 2 plus 2 is 4, I don't. Doesn't have developed yet an outlook on life that it defines things in that context. The child absorbs like a dry sponge. It may be hard to get a child's attention, but once you do, it absorbs, and retains everything. And this is touches everything in life. You'll always hear people, you're not listening to me. Usually women accuse their men more of this. You're not listening to me. And the man says, what do you mean, honey? I heard every word. And he repeats it like a tape recorder. And she says, you don't understand what I'm saying. You're not listening. I'm not talking about the words. Hearing, when you have healthy ears, you hear. Listening is an art of suspending yourself and respecting the sacred space of another person and waiting for them to finish and not in the middle of their sentence have already an opinion, what they should have said, what you wanted them to say, what they could have said. Not only not cutting them off, but even at the end, really listening to another person speak, even if you completely disagree. It requires, obviously, to be secure, confident. That was what was required when we listened to the Rebbe. It was the only way to retain. The second element, which perhaps was the driving force for the first one, was the historical one. When the Rebbe spoke, we felt as if Moses was speaking from Mount Sinai and sharing divine words that you'll hear once and once only. And if you miss it, you'll never hear it again. So if someone were to invite you to a talk that in the next half hour you're going to hear the secrets of your life forever, and no notes and no tape recorders, trust me, your adrenaline will start flowing and you'll remember a lot more than you ever thought you could. So nowadays, a lot of times someone comes over to me and says, hey, they share something with me, and I'm like daydreaming or, you know, absent-minded. And they say, so Rab, what do you think? I said, can you repeat it, you know? or if, you know, when I can't get away with like saying, just repeat that last two words again, you know? And then they'll say to me, Rabbi, are you able to remember 7 hours of the Rebbe's talks? You can't remember 5 minutes of mine? So I don't want to be the one that breaks it on them, that I don't hear any history unfolding of what they have to say. but essentially, that's what's going on. So I also don't remember. My ego gets in the way. I process or don't process or fall asleep, whatever it may be. So it's true, you have to find someone that you can listen to that way. How many people can you say that you have in your life that you're interested in listening to that way? They have things to say, and you have things to say. They have good opinions, you have good opinions. So obviously you need that blessing. But I will say this. We have a Torah that may not be a person, but the Torah also speaks. And it sings as well. And you have to know how to listen. So it's all about listening. I could go on and on with this because me and my brother talk a lot about this because we're both, so to speak, speakers. So we're always talking about speaking, you know. And we have a very interesting interaction that I've learned from Yosef Yitzchak, and maybe learned from me, about this art of listening. But I felt I wanted to put it in those...
Magnificent, fascinating, beyond the belief.
You processed everything I said?
I did. In a very serious vein, what you said, the two elements in terms of the art of listening, is something that has to be learned or cultivated or developed, and that the person who learns and cultivates it has to be special in that case. And I can tell you that I stand in awe, literally. And I don't say it chas v'chalila with Hanifa. I stand in awe of both of you that you're able to do this, to be able to prevent, to present this kind of material in such abundance. Now, I want to ask a question. Time is fleeting. I'll try to squeeze them in. But this is a question that I must ask both of you. The Rebbe succumbed on June 14, 1994. Nearly 10 years later, the movement has yet to name a successor, except for the stubborn messianists who continue to wait for the Rebbe's resurrection. And so in Lubavitch today, you have a divided community, the messianists and the non-messianists. And what I want to ask both of you is, in which camp are both of you, and what is your opinion of this really fundamental problem that is fulfilling the statement, a house divided against itself doesn't seem to stand as secure? Start with Yosef Yitzchak.
Time to sing.
Look, I would be remiss if I didn't ask this question,
obviously,
because it's on the minds of so many people, in particular, people who love Lubavitch, who respect what it has achieved, who know that it's a worldwide movement through the genius of one man and his shluchim. Therefore, I ask it with your kind permission.
A few thoughts. You know, when a synagogue burns down, God forbid, what do the Jews of the community do? They get together. Of course, they form a committee. They start raising money, and they rebuild the shul. And this has happened hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of times in the years of our diaspora in Europe, in America, and throughout the rest of the world. Yet, when the greatest synagogue of all, the Second Temple, the Beis HaMikdash, was burnt, we never encountered any serious committee of Jews who decided to come together and collect the money and rebuild the great shul. The answer is, a shul, Jews come together and rebuild. A Beis HaMikdash, a temple that Hashem rebuilds. The Rebbe was a Beis HaMikdash. But what I do think is that a few months before he suffered from his stroke, which was in 1992, it was Friday night, Sukkot. We were standing together and trying to absorb every word. And the Rebbe spoke that mysterious words. He discussed the fact that every human being is capable of being some type of Rebbe. Some type of Rebbe. And I remember standing and wondering, what are you talking about? You never said this before. Lubavitch is new. There was one Rebbe, Lubavitch a Rebbe. I still don't know if I fully understand it, but I think somewhat more. And that is, in Jewish history, there has been an evolution. In the first generations of Jewish history, there were the elders, Moses, Joshua, and the great elders who led the people. Then there were the judges. For 300 years, there were judges. The judges paved the road for kings. judges and for kings, David, Solomon, the most famous, Rehoboam, and so forth. The kings paved the way for prophets, whether Samuel the prophet, Yeshaya, the great prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Amos, and so on and so forth. Then the era of the prophets declined, and they paved the way for what's known as the Tanoim, the great Talmudists, the Amoraim, and then the Rishon, the Gaonim, the great geniuses, Rabbi Haigon, Rabbi Sadigon, who paved the way in the 1000s for the great Rishonim, Maimonides, Rashi, Nachmanides, and so on and so forth. They paved the road for the Acharonim, for the great later Jewish geniuses and scholars who paved the road for the Tzaddikim, for the Rebbes, the Baal Shem Tov, the Magid, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Bardichev, the Alter Rebbe, great Rebbes until our generation, the Lubavitcher Rebbe and other great Tzaddikim who were captains of a ship to lead the generation. So you see how history evolves? So you have kings and prophets and Talmudists and sages and geniuses and Tzaddikim and Rebbes. And who do you have today? Today is the era of human beings, of ordinary human beings, of you and I. This is today's era. This is the era. This is what the Rebbe meant 6 months before he had a stroke. Every person
is a Rebbe.
Has to become a mini Rebbe, which means today God calls upon us to rise to the occasion and to the tremendous void of the first generation in Jewish history that can be deemed almost absolutely leaderless, both in the secular world, in Israel, and in the diaspora, in the religious world as well. It is a leaderless generation. There's not one Jew that all Jews feel, he carries the world on his shoulders. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, even if you disagreed with him, but you knew, here is a man who sleeps 2 hours a night and who feels the burden of history on his shoulders. It's a tremendous burden. Today, visibly, we don't have such personality. Today is the era of human beings. Today we have to exercise tremendous courage, confidence, rise up to the occasion, and write the last chapter of Jewish history. Because the Rebbe did claim, and this is where many of the, what they call Meshachistan, feed off from. The Rebbe claimed often, if you want to understand this generation, you have to become comfortable with the term paradox. This is a meshugana generation. What makes it so meshuga? He said, this is a generation that serves as the bridge between exile and redemption. And therefore, in this generation, you have all of the symptoms of exile and all of the symptoms of redemption. That's called schizophrenia. So in this generation, you'll have a tremendous explosion of spirituality, of Jews who were assimilated for generations. And suddenly there is a voice in their heart that they want to come back. It's not Jews who weren't successful, who were losers. Jews who made it, who could be just like the Goyim and can do very well. They have risen to the highest positions in politics and in business and in the arts. And yet there is this inner calling of, I want to come back. I want to come back to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah. That's on one level. What they call the generation of Kabbalah and everything that comes with it.
Right.
On the other hand, this generation observes some very lowly, lowly, brute, crude, beastly symptoms. He said, you know why? Because this is the generation that writes the last chapter in the novel of Jewish history. And the last chapter has to bring the whole story together and has to contain within itself the highest moments and the lowest moments. It's the chapter that bridges the novel of exile with the novel of redemption. The Rebbe said it's the responsibility of this generation to actually finish the story that Abraham began and generate the romantic kiss between heaven and earth. And that kiss must be generated by ordinary, mortal, frail, moody, and turbulent human beings as and Jews.
Dysfunctional. And dysfunctional.
So I say...
You say...
I say, on one hand, we could sit and I could lament and cry because I miss the Rebbe very much. We live in very many ways in a tragic generation, especially with the blood and the pain and the tears in Israel and in so many other parts of the world. On the other hand, I think as a disciple of the Rebbe, a proud disciple of the Rebbe, I say to myself and to you, dear brothers and sisters, that we have to feel privileged to live in the generation of ordinary human beings. It's a privilege to live in such critical times and to make such a powerful contribution in such a dramatic and difficult moment of history.
Now, Simon, you have said in the course of the evening, and we're running late, about singing a song. So I'm going to spare you answering this question, unless you want to do it very briefly. What is your wish? Do you want to make some comments? Because we're running very late. I want to sing a song or two, and then I have an official formal closing for both of you. May I accommodate you to your wish?
Let's do both.
Okay.
All above.
Go ahead.
I just want to add one thing to what my brother just said. That may really, this is for the benefit of the audience and for people you may speak to, because I've dealt with this issue, the controversial issue. So I guess Yisrael Fitzhak was alluding to that the messianics and the non-messianics are both part of the schizophrenia. Is that what you were saying? I don't know. But I will say this.
They're on one side of the bridge, they're on another side of the bridge.
Yeah.
And the Jacobsons officially have to be in the middle of the bridge.
And I think this is very important because of Professor Berger's book and the questions that you've raised. In a different context, I'll speak a much more practical context. And that is, Lubavitch and Hasidism is a Torah movement. And as a Torah movement, as it was in the beginning of time when Torah was given at Sinai, everything has a source. And I say this to anyone. Everything that's said to you, whether it's someone that speaks with passionate belief in the Messiah and Mashiach, or someone that speaks with passionate disbelief, or someone that's agnostic, no matter what they say, whether it's radical or not, is not the issue. There's a Torah, there's a constitution, and we have to look at the constitution and say, what are the sources? And dispassionately and objectively, without partisanships, look. Is this a Torah concept, or is this a man-made, self-generated concept? Because after everything is said and done, even this question that Rabbi Berkowitz asked, and I appreciated the question, we both appreciated the question, there are many more questions, trust me, that we haven't even addressed here. So the question is, leaving here this evening, we're not going to answer everything. What are the tools to answer questions that we have not posed here or that have not been adequately answered for whatever reason? So I'd say to you, as a Lubavitcher and as a Jew and as a Chassid and as a human being above all, that God gave us a gift, a blueprint for life. Everything I said and everything Yisrael Fitzhak said hopefully is coming from that place. And if you want true answers, you have to look there. Sometimes you'll find part of the answer. Sometimes you'll find more. Sometimes you'll still remain a question. But that's the only way to get beyond, especially controversial issues of messianism or non-messianism. Is this Jewish? Is it not Jewish? Is it crazy? Is it normal? The fact is, in the Shemoneh Esrei, every day when we say, we also believe that the Jews believe in the resurrection, whether you like it or not. No one has cut out that prayer. Yet, what does it mean? Is this a Torah concept? Is it not? So I just will say this without getting into the details. There's a Torah that's an elaborate system. Find the right teacher, the right mentor, read it yourself, and study it. Don't do less justice to it as you would to any topic that you want to research. When people need to invest in securities, they do a lot of research because they're money. Torah concepts are even more powerful than money. Do your research, ask people, challenge, and you'll definitely get the answers to your questions. So whether it's someone that believes this way or believes that way, that's the only real solution. That's what I wanted to add.
Okay, now let me give the last question of the evening and then the formal thank you. They both said, what? Just a minute, yeah. They both said.
No. The song is also part of a question.
Just a minute. The song is also part of the question.
Right.
It certainly is. Very well said. In other words.
I always thought songs were the answers.
Well, it can be the answer after you sing the song, and maybe we'll find some answers. Okay?
We'll just light a lantern.
Right. Light a lantern as we go back to the beginning of the dialogue. Professor Heschel, in The Earth is the Lord's, defines a niggun, interestingly enough, as a tune flowing in search of its own unattainable end. A brilliant statement by a brilliant mind. Now, in Hasidism, there are all kinds of nigunim. There are drinking songs, there are wedding songs, there are marching songs, there are tish songs. So I'm going to start off with a drinking song, pass it to you, and then to you for a niggun, and then we'll close with the formal thank you for what has been, for me, and I know for everyone else, one of the most memorable evenings of the 50 years of the dialogue. Here's my song. I learned it as a child. Aglezalechaim is the beste Zach, hat gesagt und befeulen der Balschem. Von Aglezalechaim flieht der Kopf zum Dach, es vertreibt und verjagt im Sommer mem. Gedenkche Jiden, die Zavue von Balschem allein, vergesst nicht Jiden. As trinken darfen groß und klein, weil a Gläser lillecha, jem is de beste Sach, hat gesagt und befeulen der Baal Shem. Yossi. Thank you.
The chassid of those guys.
Yes.
Zing.
I will sing a song that was composed by the founder of Chabad, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi. But every song has an introduction. So Rabbi Nachman of Breslov once said that if I'm giving a speech and your cell phone goes on, or if I'm giving a speech and you start speaking in the middle of my presentation, what do we call it in English? That's the moral definition, but what is the scientific definition?
Interruption.
But what if I'm singing a song, and in the middle of my singing, you start singing, what is it called? Harmony. In a way, the essence of Hasidism is to stop speaking.
And start singing.
Because people who speak their whole life, everybody is interrupting them. People who learn how to sing, everybody's just harmonizing. So I want to bless myself and my brother and Rabbi Berkowitz and all of you that perhaps when you come home tonight, you should do a little less speaking
and a little more singing.
Please join me for this melody of Rabbi Shneur Zalman. It is a two-stanza melody. Like all of his melodies, it goes straight
to the
core. It avoids traffic. It avoids the distractions of cell phones or Seinfeld and so forth. It goes straight to the essence. One stanza represents tension. Thank you for the illustration. One stanza represents tension, and the other stanza represents
resolution.
Please join me. Kaliyata veyadeka Eloi kai Avromemeka God, and I will thank you, my soul, and I will exalt you. You are my God, and I will thank you, my soul, and I will exalt you. Hoikeli ata veyadeko loikai arako.
Simon.
This will be harder to sing along with, but try to listen at least. It's called Shamil. There's a story connected to it, but I'll just sing the song.
Give me now 2 minutes to do what I always do, because the dialogue is a structured format. There's a formal introduction, then there's free flow, and there's a formal thank you. If ever a thank you is deserving, it is deserving tonight. So I want to conclude with this final thought. The Hebrew alphabet has the letter Shin, which Jewish tradition has interpreted as representing the name of God, Shaddai. The Shin is on the mezuzah, on our doorpost. It is the Shin that is etched on the hand of the Jew wearing tefillin. In a novel by the great Shmuel Yosef Agnon, tells about a chassid named Rabbi Yudel, who when he stood in prayer before God, lifted up his hands over his head so that his two hands uplifted and his head made up the letter Shin, all of him symbolizing the name of God. I believe that that image of this rabbi can serve as the ideal of Jewish life to which we're summoned this day and to which we should commit ourselves to hold up our hands for God, for Torah, for Israel. And I believe that every Jew must himself become the living embodiment of the faith he holds, the witness upon earth of the God whose name he bears. And so long as we have men like Simon Jacobson and like Yosef Yitzchak Jacobson who continue to lift up their hands and symbolize the letter Shin and lead us in us raising our hands in the letter of the Shin, Judaism will live and Am Yisrael Chai. Thank you and good night. Let's have a standing ovation.